Well, businesses are welcoming government moves to allow 2,000 overseas seasonal workers back into the country to work in the primary sector. The workers will arrive early next year, spending 2 weeks in managed isolation at the expense of the employers, who will also be required to pay them the living wage of $22.10 an hour. The government's also announced a range of incentives to entice unemployed New Zealanders into seasonal work, including $200 a week for up to 13 weeks, with a $500 payment midway through the contract and a further $500 on completion. The Minister for Social Development and Employment, Carmel Cipollone, says payments can also help with transport costs, clothing requirements, training for the job and pastoral care. However, employers are not required to pay the living wage for anyone other than the skilled labourers coming from the Pacific under this deal. Is the discrepancy in pay going to be justifiable? Does it expose low wages as a fundamental problem in the sector's labour market woes? And what are the implications also for other sectors? With us, Kirk Hope, Chief Executive of Business New Zealand. Good morning, Kirk.
Good morning.
And good morning also to Alan Pollard, Chief Executive of New Zealand Apples and Pears.
Good morning.
Alan, there'll be a big sigh of relief, I imagine, for many in the horticultural sector. What will this announcement mean?
Yeah, look, the announcement's very welcome. We've been, myself and my colleagues from other sectors, have been working with the government for a little while now on the labour demand and supply deficit, and particularly on the economic and social consequences if we can't get support across the industries to get our crops off the trees. So 2,000 is a welcome number. It's not enough to plug the deficit, but it's on the right track.
What is the scale of the deficit?
Well, I mean, our modelling shows that in the peak of our harvest, when we overlap with kiwi fruit in March, there's about 11,000 worker shortage at that point. Now, there's a lot of variables go into that, but that's the deficit we were looking at. So this certainly goes some way towards it. We are grateful for the number.
Do you expect it's the first tranche and there will be more workers allowed in to mitigate that overlap and that shortage in March?
Well, the government's committed to continuing to talk with us about any adjustments to the settings that were announced, and very clearly they're trying to balance the support for our industry with also ensuring there's plenty of MIQ space available for returning Kiwis. Some of our regions have looked at the options of privately owned government-managed isolation facilities, and our view is that's a worthy narrative to continue with. So we are hopeful that the dialogue may also produce further numbers later down the track.
Is that question alive? Do you have open ears, do you think, on the question of perhaps having managed isolation facilities in regions near to where workers are needed and perhaps boosting the number of overall beds available in the system? Is that alive?
Well, the dialogue's certainly alive, and there's a willingness on both parties to continue to talk about it. But the immediate challenge is trying to get these 2,000 people in the spaces that are available without compromising, you know, the likes of New Zealanders returning home, for example, which is the first priority.
How was this arrangement struck with the government? Can you give us some insight into what each side pushed for?
Yeah, well, obviously from industry side, our aim was to try and bridge as much of that labour deficit as possible. So we put in front of them a very compelling case about the consequences of not getting some good decision-making in a timely way done. The government listened to that, and on their side, they've come back and acknowledged that they had some challenges, particularly around the spaces and MIQ availability. And as I said, that need not to displace New Zealanders who want to come home first. So as a first tranche, I think we've struck a really good balance, but there's a lot more talking to be done.
Can we talk about some of the incentives, though? It's interesting, these additional incentives, because obviously the government's perspective is we want New Zealanders filling vacancies first in any sector.
Yes.
We have rising unemployment. And so they've obviously talked to you about what they're prepared to do to help your industry with that. Do we know what the total sum is of the package that they're offering by means of subsidy? This is the $200 a week for up to 13 weeks, a payment halfway through a contract, etc. What's the size of that package?
Yeah, look, I'm not sure what that means for each individual, but certainly the government's listened to some of our concerns. One of the challenges we have with unemployed New Zealanders is they tend to be clustered largely in the larger urban areas and metropolitan areas. And so mobility is a real challenge. And some of these incentives, you know, for example, the accommodation incentive, where some of these people will have rent or mortgage obligations where they live, just add to that encouragement to get them to move for the few weeks that we need them at our peak.
So is that basically aimed at trying to cover rent? Is that a large part of what that extra payment's for?
Certainly helping towards it, yeah. But there's other incentives too. There's an incentive partway through their program. There's an incentive of $1,000 if they complete the job after 6 weeks or 6 weeks or longer. There's other incentives too. You know, if you qualify for the benefit and are prepared to move and continue to work in the role for over 91 days, then you qualify for a $5,000 subsidy as well. So, you know, the government's been very generous in trying to come up with innovative solutions just to support that mobility part and to encourage New Zealanders into the industry.
What were the conversations that were had about the living wage?
Hello, we've had discussions with government about wage rates for a long, long time, and the industry has been working hard to, you know, to continue to improve the opportunity for New Zealanders to maximise the income. The workers that are coming back are highly skilled workers, and the reason for that, of course, is that with smaller numbers, we want them to be as productive as possible. So they're well-trained, well-experienced, and very clearly, the more experience you have, the more you're likely to earn. So a lot of those workers will be engaged in tasks, particularly on Orchard, where they're more likely to earn more than that. There's also labour demand and supply forces at work here, Catherine, as well. And the reality is there's competition for labour, and that means that there's competition around prices as well.
Did the government insist on the living wage? That's the bottom line. You're not getting this deal without it.
No, that's true. And look, I think that's a fair call because the government's concerned about, as I said, maximising the income opportunities, particularly for those people who have either been unemployed for some time or displaced. And so it was a robust discussion, I have to say. But as I said, industry has been working on wage rates for some time now with government, so it's not unexpected.
Do you expect that then all employees will be paid the living wage, whether or not they're on the REC scheme?
Well, as I said, wage rates are attached to experience. And so, you know, you'd expect people who are more experienced than others to earn more than others, to be honest. And you'd expect people who are new entrants into the industry and still undergoing training and collecting that experience to earn a little less. So, you know, will there be a trickle-down across wages? I'm sure there'll be some pressure, but the reality is we pay for experience.
Is there a compatibility with employment law, however, that's going to be required? In other words, if there are domestic workers who are matching the performance and output of the REC workers, well, they're going to have to get the living wage, aren't they?
Yeah, look, I'm afraid I'm not a lawyer, Catherine, and maybe Kirk has a better understanding of how this fits with employment law than I do.
All right. On the question of wage rates overall, can you explain more about the structure of the industry and other seasonal industries, actually? Because every time we discuss the labour shortage issues in the REC scheme, we have to say we're up to 14,400 places it was supposed to be this year, up from 8,000 over a decade ago. So every time we discuss the challenges and, you know, people are worried about crops rotting on the ground, we hear from people saying the wages are too low, you don't get paid if it's a non-picking day because it's raining, you know, the costs of moving, the costs of accommodation. What has the industry done to combat some of those barriers? What's possible, yeah, what's not?
Yeah, I mean, look, I can only speak for our industry, obviously, but yeah, I look at what's happened in the industry over the last decade, and what's happened is, particularly in the orchards where they're paid on piece rates, so you pay for what you do, the ability to pick a bin of fruit has become much easier than it was 10 years ago. So, you know, we now have shorter trees, much smaller trees. They are on what's called a two-dimensional structure, so much easier to access, and they're much more highly productive varieties, which means the fruit is clustered in a much smaller area. So your ability to pick a bin of fruit has probably doubled over the last decade, and that's a real increase in wage rates because you paid by bin. So there's a lot of structural and functional changes that have been made on the orchard to make it a lot easier for someone to earn a significant amount of money, obviously for the work that they do.
How does it work with respect to the minimum wage and or the living wage or pick per piece? Is it one or the other? In other words, you either commit to being paid by the volume you pick each hour, or you commit to being paid an hourly wage. How does it work?
Yeah, that's right. And those who are confident in their ability to work, you know, quickly and effectively and productively will most likely choose the piece rate because they'll earn much more money. Those who aren't may be more comfortable with the minimum wage. And bear in mind, within the industry, if a worker doesn't do enough, if you like, to earn sufficient to achieve the minimum wage, we have to top those wages up to at least the minimum wage, even without that productivity.
What are the profit margins like for the average business in your sector?
Look, it varies by business and by business, by size, by operation. There's really no standard. I couldn't really make a comment on that.
And what impact would extending the living wage to all workers mean for the cost of fruit? I'm already hearing from you that many workers get paid by volume anyway. But if that living wage were to become the norm, what would be the impact?
Well, very clearly, if businesses take on a greater cost structure, they need to try and pass that on to try and preserve their own margins. So that is possible sometimes, but sometimes it's not as well, because when you're selling into international markets, you're at the whim of the ability to negotiate prices with those markets. So it's not always easy to pass that on. That means then that margins get cut.
In your sector anyway, apples and pears, is it likely that many of the REC workers who are now guaranteed a living wage will in fact be being paid by the piece anyway, by volume anyway?
Yes, okay. Many will be, absolutely.
A vast majority?
I would say so, yes.
So is it kind of symbolic?
You could say it's symbolic. I mean, I think what it clearly shows, though, is the government is committed to ensuring that, as I said, people have an opportunity to maximise their income, and this clearly demonstrates one way of doing that. Our aim is to obviously give those people work in the areas that are most productive and most profitable for them so they can earn even more.
Thanks very much, Alan. Stay with us if you have time. Chief Executive of New Zealand Apples and Pears, Kirk Hope is Chief Executive of Business New Zealand. Welcome back, Kirk. Business New Zealand also welcoming this deal that's been struck?
Yeah, I mean, for all the reasons that Alan outlined, and the reality that many of the workers that might be available are not in places where they're needed. I think just going back to that point that Alan made about the living wage, that discussion, it's quite an important one. The workers who are coming in on the REC scheme are, as and outline, pretty experienced. What they can do what having them here may be able to help with is training New Zealanders and some of the to be more productive in terms of the harvest, so that they themselves can get paid more money. I think it's really important that those workers that are able to be more productive are likely to get paid much more than the living wage. And that's an important feature, I think, that's not well understood about the industry, that productive workers are paid well over minimum wage and probably well above the living wage.
That's an interesting point, though, that we reach at the end of the interview, that the most experienced workers, the REC workers, it is almost symbolic, this living wage as a minimum, because most of them will be being paid by the piece. Now, that's reasonably unique to this industry, certainly compared to some of the others we'll talk about in a moment. What do you believe the purpose was in locking in that living wage clause to the deal?
Look, I think it sends a signal. I think it's a combination of a couple of things. I think there has been a long misunderstanding about actual pay in the sector by the government, and they've made statements about people being underpaid in the industry, and I think that's simply not accurate in many cases. I think it's a challenge for people. There's also a bit of a misunderstanding about the skills needed to be productive in the sector. Actually, there are a range of skills that you need to be productive in that sector. And quite a bit of training that needs to happen for you to be productive, and quite a lot of experience that you need. You can't just walk into a horticultural business and be expected to pick it up really, really quickly and be highly productive. I mean, it's going to take a little bit of time. And I think there are a lot of those things that aren't really well understood about the industry. It's often still seen as, you know, we get some students to pick some apples, that'd be fine. But it's much more sophisticated than that these days.
This includes vineyards as well, of course, who have their own peculiarities in pruning requirements. But I'm more interested in what this has in common with other sectors is seasonality. It's not like a permanent job, per se, for most people. And I'm curious that the precedent in some ways has been set here in linking the bringing in of these workers to the living wage, and whether this is, as you say, a signal to many other seasonal sectors, including the one we're about to talk to in a moment, that the government wants higher wages and more domestic workers. Your comment?
Well, I mean, that could be the implication. I mean, but the reality is you're still probably going to have some form of labour gap in seasonal work because there simply is not the population bases in those regions at the time that you need, which is why the RSE scheme was developed. And it's a useful two-way mechanism. Firstly, it helps support New Zealand's aid into the Pacific. So when Pacific Islanders come here, they earn, by and large, pretty good incomes for those seasons, and then they can go back. Then they go back to the islands, and they have, have a better income. So it's a two-way street. We get the benefit of having their productive labour harvesting our crops. As Alan outlined in the early part of the interview, there has always been a gap. Those RSE workers, the demand for those RSE workers has been increasing because, again, we don't have the population bases in the places where our horticultural industries are to really continue to support that. So we do need to fill gaps sometimes.
What are the other industries that will or already are in the queue for the government begging for more people to come across the border?
In the horticultural and agricultural industries, because they're seasonally based, maybe farming, some farming less so, but they're all under the pump in terms of, there simply aren't enough people in the right places to do the jobs at the moment. So anything to do with our agricultural and horticultural production, they really need. They need skilled labour. This is not unskilled labour, and it's unfair to characterise it in that way. The other areas where we're seeing a lot of demand are particularly for industrial plants. There are less people that are needed, but they're still struggling to get some of those people into New Zealand because of the voucher system and the competition with returning New Zealanders. So some of those maintenance projects are time based, so they'll have to shut plants down if maintenance can't be done because insurance won't be able to be maintained if the maintenance isn't done.
Are you hearing anything about increasing the number of beds in managed isolation facilities and possibly locating them closer to where the employment source is? Are there open minds on that or not?
A tricky situation for the government, actually. One of the things that could be thought about is where, say, for example, people are coming from the Pacific Islands, which is pretty low risk in terms of COVID, there might be, and this would, of course, depend on New Zealanders' tolerance for this, because we have seen, most of the issues arise at the border. If there was an opportunity for, very low-risk countries to get people coming from very low-risk countries to go into privately run managed isolation facilities, that might alleviate some of the pressure. Some of the pressure has simply been, of course, because of New Zealanders returning for Christmas, and some of that has started to dissipate. The other area where, if we could open up the Trans-Tasman bubble, that frees up about 40% of the capacity of MIQ, because, those returning people coming into New Zealand from Australia don't need to quarantine. So, you know, that frees up a lot of space, actually. It's probably more space than you would need for certain industries. It won't be enough for, say, for example, a return of even part of the international student cohort.
Your levels of optimism around that, though, we just saw Queensland dismiss the idea recently of being part of that. And what is the temperature test on this side of the Tasman for opening that bubble anytime soon?
Yeah, good question. Probably one for the government. What do I think about it? Look, I mean, again, those choices need to be made extremely carefully, because every time you do that, there is the potential for, as you increase the numbers of people coming across the border, there is the potential for an increase in risk. And I think that, I think probably New Zealanders have pretty low tolerance for lockdowns, even regional lockdowns that occur as a result of, someone coming across the border and introducing COVID into a community. So those things have to be very, very carefully balanced.
Thank you, Kirk Kirkhope, Chief Executive of Business New Zealand.